mortgage rates, meanwhile, dropping to a three-year low amid today's sell-off.
Well, John, rates could move even lower today with the average on the 30-year fix dipping toward the mid-threes.
You know, I think we're going to have a lot of sideways trade here over the next couple weeks as maybe the administration starts to work things out a little differently with China, or as we get a little bit more clarity what they might be doing with the yuan.
My expectation is that the U.S. may strike a small deal around China agreeing to purchase more U.S. goods to take down the trade deficit to zero.
Like a sidebar deal almost.
But I think it could be framed as the main deal.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
China labeled a currency manipulator as the Chinese yuan went above 7 for the first time in many, many years. Presidential tweets are making the market nervous. This trade war could be continuing well into the fall. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me today, our technician will be John Roque from Wolf Research. He says the long-term trend is still in place. But wait till you hear what he has to say about global interest rates. It's going to be a shocker. He also likes gold, and he thinks we're going to take out the old record of 1900. Also joining me from Bloomberg Commodity Markets, Mike McClone will be joining us. He's also bullish on gold, not as bullish on the rest of the commodities sector, especially when it comes to copper and oil. And, of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets. And then later on, Chris Prytower and myself will talk about what this really is. We're involved in a full-scale trade war with 90% of economists now calling it a trade war. We're not talking about trade tensions anymore. It's become a war. All of that coming up in today's program.
Well, we want to welcome back to the studio Ryan Poplava. Ryan, there was a lot of news this week, particularly around the trade war. And it seemed like the markets were just seesawing as a result of that and other news. I've been really looking forward to your take on what moved the markets this week.
Yeah, definitely, Chris. It was volatile week. I think the biggest catalyst this week was regarding trade, currencies, and then falling yields and what that communicated to the markets. Front and center news, really, all week long. Chinese hinted last week that they would begin to move against the U.S. in retaliation for the raised tariffs. And they did that. First thing Monday, Bloomberg reported that Chinese state-owned companies were asked to halt purchases of U.S. agricultural goods. In addition to that, on Monday, the People's Bank of China allowed the yuan to weaken past 7 per dollar, where it has stabilized as of Friday. Now, if you take a look at just Monday's trading, let's look at some of the damage that was done. The iShares MSCI Emerging Markets ETF slid down 3.9% within points of last year's low. Investors were basically de-risking all day long. It was a very slow grind lower. Some called it controlled selling over that uncertainty with the impact on global growth as trade escalations continue. Now, Treasury yields dropped further, flattening the yield curve, and that was another signal that the market was transmitting that, hey, de-risk, get out of stocks, get into Treasury bonds, and that essentially was communicated all that day long. Now, what halted the selling, which continued on through Tuesday morning in Asia, was an announcement by the People's Bank of China that it would stabilize the fix, which helped stoke kind of a rebound back in those risk assets as things have basically gotten a little overdone on the downside short term, technically, and that definitely helped. Wednesday, three central banks in the Asia-Pacific region lowered short-term rates. That's New Zealand, India, and Thailand, with New Zealand signaling they may cut into negative territory. That just tells you, Chris, that anybody with Chinese trade relations appear pressured by the move in their currency to do something themselves. So these were all surprise cuts. Now, you have to wonder if trade wars are now shifting possibly to currency wars. Definitely. That's taking place. Nobody wants their currency to be overvalued in a paradigm where tariffs are also increasing the cost of goods for their export-oriented economies of the the Asia Pacific. We saw this back in 1997. You know, there was such a huge issue with PEGs unwinding and real battles in that expert-led Asia Pacific economies. You know, those were very heated economies at that time.
You know, Ryan, I was surprised that China blinked as soon as they did. I really expected it to last days longer, maybe even weeks. But the market did seem quite relieved by that turn of events. So was there anything else this week, Ryan, that restored confidence back on risk assets besides the Chinese stabilizing the peg now at a higher rate, around 7 per dollar?
Well, China reported a surprise year-over-year increase in exports for July, but I think the technical setup played a small part with essentially buying coming in after an excessive move to the downside for stocks. Now, the percentage of stocks within the S&P 500 above their 50-day moving average, this is kind of an intermediate level that I watch, got down to around 19%. And anytime you see that level drop down to below 30%, that's an oversold condition. It doesn't necessarily speak that, you know, it's immediately going to reverse. It just tells you, hey, things are a little overdone. And that's essentially what happened. Additionally, there was some really good news in earnings from Advanced Micro Devices on Thursday that essentially led Philadelphia Semiconductor Index to really big gains after they unveiled their server CPUs that reportedly Google and Twitter will use. So through all of the surprise rate cuts and the higher peg for the yuan, gold shined through it all, just reaching above 1,500 per ounce this week to settle Friday at right around 1,508. Now, gold is almost up about 14.9% year-to-date, pretty close to the year-to-date return on the S&P 500. Guess what that is? 16.4%. So not that far. You know, you think risk on, risk on. You got to be in stocks. You got to be in stocks. They're kicking butt this year. So is gold. Looking at where things stand today, falling rates could further embolden the what we call the TINA trade, which stands for there is no alternative. Because you look at the 10-year Treasury now yielding less than the S&P 500. You know, that encourages people to move out further on the risk curve. And that was the plan of central bankers in years past after the financial crisis to get people to invest further out there. So that's helping hold up stocks, but eventually the higher valuation will have to be justified by earnings growth. The second quarter earnings so far this season, we got about 90% of the companies reporting so far, showing a decline right around 0.7% for the quarter, according to FactSet. So looking at that, if we settle here, that would be the first earnings recession, so two down quarters year over year since 2016. Now, that doesn't lead into recessions, but like I said, the higher the PE floats on the S&P 500 as you know, the risk-free rate falls, the more we'll need to see earnings kind of support valuation, support why stocks move higher on an accommodative Fed. The other question that keeps me wondering is how much further will sovereign rates get into negative territory? We've got them all over in Europe. And recently, this week, New Zealand talked about that they think their rates could possibly be heading down, at least short-term, into negative territory. What does that mean? And what's that going to do? It's definitely adding pressure to the U.S. Treasury yields. And if anything, eventually, someday, not right now, maybe a year from now, maybe later, I really believe that the next bubble is eventually going to be in these negative rates and that pressure it's putting on U.S. Treasury yields.
Well, it will be interesting to see how much further those rates go into negative territory and how much further the trade war will continue. But either way, Ryan, it's always a pleasure to have you stop by the studio. We'll look forward to next week when we have you stop by again and let us know what's moving the markets.
Sure thing, Chris.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
There are now bubbles building up on bond markets all over the world. And I would have been far happier had there been a really healthy correction, particularly of the equity markets at the beginning of the year. And I thought that was going to happen until Mr. Trump actually intervened, and I think it's partly because of his bullying tactics that the Fed has now started to think about easing again. And therefore, it would have been much better had there been, I think, a short, sharp correction on both the bond and the equity markets, instead of which we see bubble-like behavior affecting all these markets. And the public investors that we are highlighting in this report, as you mentioned, Chris, nearly $38 trillion worth of assets, they're going to be hit as well as anybody else once the inevitable downturn comes, and once there is also something of a repricing of these hopelessly overdone asset markets.
Everyone wants to retire well. That's not as easy as it sounds. You need to make the right investment choices, decide when to take Social Security, plan for taxes on your retirement income, and create a legacy for your family. To retire well, you need a roadmap to help you get there. Let Financial Sense Wealth Management help you navigate your way to retirement. We provide comprehensive, thoughtful, and personal retirement planning. Call Financial Sense Wealth Management now at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Start your journey to retiring well today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
It's been a tough week for the markets this week. Tensions over trade war, the Chinese yuan depreciating against the dollar, and it looks like there's no sign of agreement between the two largest economies in the world. Let's see how this plays out in the market. Joining us on the program is John Roque. And John, we were talking before we went on the air about what's going on in Hong Kong. Some of the financial and property stocks are not doing well. Let's begin there.
Okay, Jim, thanks for having me. It's good to be with you again. Our work has been negative on Asia for some time, especially right after the G20 meeting when the meeting ended and we got, at least in quotations, good news that Trump and Xi had come to some sort of, you know, closer activity. But we thought it was curious that the Asian markets did not embrace this good news, especially Hong Kong. And there's a lot of weakness in the Hang Seng, which on Bloomberg, if anybody's using it, is HSI index, and also the HSCEI index, and in particular, the two biggest components from a group point of view for the Hang Seng are the financials and the property stocks. And both of those indexes are under a lot of pressure. So I would say the crux of Asia, of course, is focused on China, but the Hang Seng is taking the brunt of it right here.
And also, it's being reflected in some of these international indexes like EEM and EFA. So let's talk about that. It seems like a lot more of the damage is being done overseas.
There's no doubt. In fact, here at Wolf Research, we employ a technical scoring system where we score anything that has a price on a 0 to 4 scale. And while the U.S. is holding up relatively better, there are no indexes in Asia with top scores. No secret given what we're going through here. But the scoring for our work has deteriorated a lot. And of course, that's being reflected in the two ETFs that you mentioned.
You know, I want to just shift gears a little bit and focus on the bond market, because you've got a third of all sovereign debt with negative yields. I don't know what the ECB is going to be doing. They're already at a negative 0.4%. But John, when the Fed had its meeting last week, the markets were disappointed. He said, hey, this is not really a beginning of a Fed rate lowering cycle. It's a mid-cycle. And it seems like they've had to walk that back. But boy, you take a look at what's happened with the 10-year and what's happened with the 30-year in the inversion on the short end. Let's talk about bonds.
So, Jim, we think it wouldn't be strange if, you know, it could be shorter, of course, but in the next few years that every major interest rate in the world is going to be negative.
Wow.
Of course, the U.S. would be the last to join the party. But I don't think it doesn't take a lot of imagination to think this. And if you look at the U.S. 10-year, in light of what the rest of the G7 is doing, there's almost no way you could believe that the U.S. rate can go up without the others going up, given their historical correlations. So we think rates will, at the very least, stay low, but more likely continue to work lower.
So when you take a look at that, and if there is this possibility that, let's say, I know there are a lot of smart people out there that are predicting that the 10-year goes below 1, you're suggesting even the possibility it goes negative, which very well could be if you take a look at globally what's going on. John, what would that mean for stocks? I mean, I just read a report for pension funds. They all failed to meet their objective of 7.5% returns over the last 12 months. were people going to go for yields? It seems like the only place you can get a decent yield is in the stock market, which seems strange.
Well, it would seem to me that the two natural beneficiaries would likely be utilities and real estate. But I also think a beneficiary is gold, not because it pays a yield, but because it doesn't cost you anything to hold it if rates are going to be very low or negative. So I think gold is a natural beneficiary in this deflationary environment.
John, we've seen gold struggle for several years trying to break out above 1350, 1360. It took out 1400 and then 1500. Where could you see gold going in this negative interest rate environment that is a possibility in the years ahead?
We think, Jim, that gold makes a new all-time high. So the former all-time high was going back to, I guess it was 2011 or thereabouts. And it was around, 2011, it was around $1,915 or so. And we think gold in this cycle is going to make a new all-time high. As you noted, gold finally completed by getting above the high 1300s and 1400, a 6.25-year base. In our parlance, that's a major big base. We refer to it as Brobdingnagian, which is a word from Gulliver's Travels, which means huge. And we think the breakout from the big base and the continued negative yields are going to be enough to propel gold to a new all-time high.
Wow. And so that would suggest that, the last one was 1900, so even higher. Now, John, what about, one of the things that we're starting to see now, I think that's confirming this move by gold, and I'd like to hear your comments. In the past, you'd see gold go up, and it would rally, but silver would never go along. Now you're starting to see silver break out. You're also starting to see the gold mining stocks confirm things like GDX, and even the juniors are starting to break out. As you look at the precious metals markets, what about silver?
We also like silver, Jim, and we realize that silver should participate with a gold bull market. And normally, in a gold bull market, silver does outperform. However, because this is less to us about an inflationary environment, and because silver also has some industrial components, it might be that in this environment, gold does outperform because it really is the anti-currency. But we do think that silver participates.
So in this deflationary environment, is that explaining, John, why if you take a look at the commodity sector, gold, silver is doing well. If you look at things like oil, if you take a look at things like copper, they are not doing well. Does this kind of confirm the deflationary environment and a slowing global economy?
I'm clearly no economist. So I'm going to say this is what we are surmising, that there is some slowing going on, and the commodity complex as a whole is referencing that. It's very odd to us because if you look at it historically, when gold is usually the first of the commodities to move, and then the others sort of get the whiff a little bit later on, and then they participate. So we're mindful that this has occurred in the past, but unless oil really does turn, and our work suggests that it's going to remain weak, unless oil turns, it's going to be really hard for the rest of the commodity complex to do well. In particular, we're focused on gold and silver here because they're the leaders, and gold being the leader between the two metals.
As we go back to the stock market, looking at the S&P, it seems like the sectors that are holding up better, you have consumer staples, you have utilities, and then, of course, you have real estate. Is this more of a yield play, a safety play? And if you were investing in stocks, John, would you stay on the defensive side at this point?
So I'm going to answer the latter part of your question first. I think most people in the business are reluctant to say anything, especially concerning, because our opinion really is our only currency, and how right or how infrequently wrong we are really is the way we're paid, so to speak. And I think people are reluctant to do any sort of cautionary commentary because if it turns, they feel foolish that they missed the turn. Here's what we know is that when major turns occur, you don't have to buy the low. Usually when major turns occur, they're in for some length of time. You get a major moves over time, which are usually years in length. Just to give you an idea, the low was in 2009, and here we are in 2019. And the uptrend is still in force, albeit a little bit tattered of late. So that's a long-winded way to say we think it's going to likely to be difficult here, and to be a little bit more cautious is probably the right call.
As you mentioned, when turns happen, as they did in 2009, they tend to be long-term plays, which is certainly what we've seen since 2009. So overall, you're a bit cautious, But as you look at this market, John, do you think that uptrend is still in place and this is a corrective move that we're seeing here?
We think the uptrend is still in place and we think this is a corrective move in the uptrend. We don't have enough evidence yet to suggest that this is going to be more important. There's just not enough evidence. So I agree with what you said.
So if this was to turn and maybe go in the opposite direction and turn negative, what would be the things that you would be looking for to tell you we may be getting close to a pivot here?
So a pivot to get worse, you mean?
Yes.
So from our perspective, we would think that you'd have to see some weakness in the major leaders in this market, stocks like Microsoft, stocks like Visa, MasterCard, the stocks that had been the major leaders. If they come in, then I think we have to start to question just how deep or how important the current corrective phase or you know, softness will be. I think it's going to have to come from the leaders, the stocks that have provided the greatest push or portfolio rewards over the last several years.
Now, John, I want to come back to interest rates because, as you had mentioned earlier, there's a possibility we could see negative interest rates around the globe. But if you look at the bond market where it is today, we have an inversion on the short end with the 3-month higher than the 10-year. So a lot of people are saying this could reflect a possible recession in the future. Certainly, every recession in the last half century has been preceded by a negative or an inverted yield curve. But how much of an indicator is that when you have central banks intervening in markets with quantitative easing as much as they are?
I think you said it perfectly. I none of us know how important the indicator is here because we believe that we no longer have economic cycles. We have central bank cycles or monetary easing cycles. So it's very difficult to make historical correlations or historical comparisons because the inputs are different. We happen to agree with you 100%, Jim. You just said it better than we did.
And I want to talk about this kind of market in general because, you know, we used to have, as you pointed out, we have these long-lasting trends. But, John, how difficult has this been in your job when you can wake up one day and all of a sudden there's a presidential tweet that goes out and it completely changes the composition or the trading in the market that day? How difficult of a market has this been for you to navigate?
I think it's especially difficult if you are very tied to daily pricing. And a lot of people are because most of markets are made on the margin or there are a lot of profits that are made on the margin. So I think daily pricing action is fraught with a lot of dislocation and you get taken out of items that you should be with and you get put into items that you shouldn't be put into. So I think the daily action is fraught with difficulty. However, I would like to also say that sometimes, and it's hard when you're mark to market on a daily basis. So I'm not telling anybody how to do their job. And clearly, it's a difficult one when you're mark to market on a daily basis, as nearly everyone is. But sometimes your better decisions are made when you're considering longer term charts, let's say like weeklies or monthlies. And by looking at those charts, you get a sense of the trend. And it might tell you that this is an item where you want to be buying as it's pulled back because of some daily commentary from the president or somebody who's tweeting. Or you might want to be selling because you got a pop because of that same type of commentary. And we think the clarity comes not necessarily with daily charts, but in weekly and monthly charts.
And finally, John, given what you're seeing in the charts right now, as an investor, what would you be doing?
Well, I think sometimes it's right to take a deeper look, take a deep breath, of course. And it's not crazy to think that we might go through a difficult period here. Gold is winning. Yields continue to stay low and go lower. And stocks are starting to struggle a little bit. We've had a 9-year up move. Not that crazy to think that we could do nothing here for a little while. That's the way we're thinking about it.
All right. Well, listen, John, as we close, if our listeners like to follow the great work that you do, how could they do so?
I'm at Wolf Research now, and you know they can certainly contact us here.
All right. Well, listen, John, have yourself a great weekend and a great rest of the summer.
Thank you, Jim. Always a pleasure to be with you.
You betcha. Bye-bye.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
The U.S. economy is doing okay, but the markets are saying that's a history lesson. We're looking forward, and we don't like what we see, and we don't like that our interest rates are the highest in the world. They're too restrictive, and we see nothing but problems coming down the road. That doesn't mean they're guaranteed to be problems, but they means act on it now. Don't wait until you see signs of weakness. Eric Rosengren wrote this last week. Eric Rosengren, he's the Boston Fed president, put out a bunch of charts and statistics. He says, I don't see any problems with the economy. And I said, think of the yield curve as a blood marker that says the presence of cancer may be in your system, may be in your system. Do you then say, well, I don't see a 5-pound tumor in my body, so I'll just wait till the 5-pound tumor shows up before I go see an oncologist? No, you start acting right away. And that's exactly what he seems to be saying. I see no 5-pound tumor in the economy. Well, if you wait then, it's too late. And that's why the market wants you to act now.
Well, about 6 weeks ago, we did a show and told you in many reasons why you might want to own gold. On the day we're doing this interview, gold is breaking out and looks like it's heading to 1500. And also, we're going to be talking about oil, which seems to be struggling to remain in the 50s. Joining me on the program is Mike McGlone. He's Bloomberg's commodity strategist. Mike, let's begin with gold, because on the day you and I are doing this interview, we've got gold at around 1476. So what's your take on gold? Is the currency turmoil, the trade wars that we're seeing, is this what is driving this?
I think it's all the above. First thing to think about gold right here is it's finally reached it. Not so significant as far as a big picture, because it's retracing a bear market. And that bear market really started and it peaked around 2011-12, and then it bottom in 2015. Right now, just today, as we speak, our timing is impeccable. We're retracing about halfway that bear market. So it's like the first good resistance around gold around 1480. And you mentioned 1476. To me, the big picture for gold is my key fear is I don't see what's going to take for gold prices to go lower, but I can see a lot of reasons for it to go higher. You mentioned a few. One of the most significant things for the price of dollar price of gold is obviously the US dollar. Now, the US dollar continues to show strength, but gold is showing divergent strength to that. You mentioned earlier, and you've said on the other programs, we have this global race to debase. We have a lot of low rates and much lower rates in Europe. We have negative yielding debt, and you have the U.S. Fed reducing rates. So that's obviously a positive for gold. The other key factor is increasing stock market volatility. Now, I'm not saying the stock market has to go up or down. It's just increasing volatility. And the significance is last year, before the market really volatility started picked up, volatility in the stock market, S&P 500, the VIX reached multi-decade lows. And that's what gold volatility did just a few months ago. It reached a multi-decade low. Now, I'm using a 260-day, so it's an annualized measure. So all indicators for me for gold point up, but now we're at the first good resistance of the year. It's not the place you want to, you know, as a trader, you want to be careful. But overall, I suspect there'll be bids below the market on dips. And I look at 1400 as now the first good support, and the 1500 is in this area's first good resistance.
So as we look at the situation we have today, and we can remember gold breaking out with the announcement of QE, I think it was QE2 in September of 2010, I want to talk about where we are today. We've begun a global easing cycle, but unlike the last global easing cycle, let's say that began in 2007, Mike, the Fed only got up to 2.5% on the Fed funds rate. If you look at Europe today, they're at a negative 40 basis points. You've got negative rates in Japan. It seems to me this has got to be very gold bullish because central banks aren't starting with the same loaded chambers to fight off, let's say, volatility, a downturn or recession as they did in the past.
So true. Typically and historically, one of the key things that drove the price of gold was inflation or debasement of currencies. Now it's more the opposite. It's we're getting deflation or disinflation, negative yielding debt. And for that store value gold, it actually enhances the value. There's just so much room now with no inflation for them to just continue to cut rates, continue to potentially print money or debase their currencies or whatever by their own debt until they see inflation. And I don't see the end game. And this is what gold has been doing for, it basically bottomed when the Fed started tightening. And that was in December 2015. And I think it was looking forward to the end game of that tightening cycle. That's what just started just a few weeks ago. The Fed started to ease. But by many measures, they're far behind the curve. So overall, I don't see what's going to take to go lower. And I think what you're seeing is a sentiment shift, significant sentiment shifts globally, that a lot of the equity run has maybe run its course, and people are looking for more diversification and value, and certainly seeing gold. And I hate to say it too, but you're seeing some of that in Bitcoin.
So you're seeing Bitcoin go up, and let's talk about the correlation between the two, because normally when you had, let's say, alternatives to currency, it was mainly precious metals. It was gold and silver, and I want to get to silver in a minute, but now we have cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, well, that's the key thing. Now we have something different. And just like it was 2004, so we didn't have a gold ETF, and now we have that. So people don't have to just buy gold equities. They don't have to buy it and store it in a vault and buy jewelry. They can just get exposed to an ETF. And now we have an alternative, and that's cryptos. And I would look at it as not so much the market, as gold is one of 118 elements, and it's one of the best performing, and it's kind of leaving everything behind right now because of from investors. The same thing as I look in cryptos. Bitcoin is one of 2,400 cryptos, and it's 65% of total value, and it's leaving things behind because it has that global cachet and store of value and interest. And people, I think, are getting it. And yeah, sure, it's a bit elevated. It's had a good run, but I'm sensing bids below the market, and the macro trends are quite positive, as you see what we mentioned earlier. Same macro trends are positive. But the key thing is also is historically, it wasn't really much a correlation on a daily basis, you know. But lately, if you measure like the 200-day beta, Bitcoin over gold, it's about almost two, meaning that's based on 200-day basis. And historically, that 200-day beta has been near zero.
Typically in the past, when we saw gold trying to break out above 1350, 1360, Mike, silver was lagging. The gold stocks are lagging. Now we've got silver starting to break out. We've got the gold stocks taking off. So it seems like precious metals are all in alignment. Let's talk about silver for a moment, because it has been up until recently a laggard. And when you get big moves in precious metals, usually in the end, silver tends to outperform. What do you see in silver right now?
I think it's playing catch up, and I think you're spot on. Typically, the nicknames for silver are leveraged gold or the devil's metal, by some people call it, but it typically has a very high beta to gold. And when gold goes up 1%, historically, silver's gone up about 101.5%. And same inverse correlation to the dollar. It is the higher inverse correlation to the U.S. dollar. So if the dollar is eventually peaking, silver shall run it. But silver is more than 50% industrial demand now. In the past, 20 years ago, it was 30%. So it's been a little bit under pressure for other reasons with mining supply and everything. But overall, I think it's just catching up like platinum is. Palladium has been the leader. But overall, the whole space has a lot of value. And that's in these industrial currencies that you can store for next to nothing or get in an ETF. Yet foreign currencies versus something like copper, which I can really get an ETF. It's difficult and expensive to store, so it's gaining value. But silver is at some point, it should be catching up, but I think it's finally doing that. But the question is the duration. And in a gold rallying environment, silver typically leads.
So let's look at some of the other metals. And I want to go back and talk about one that seems to be breaking down, and that is copper. What's your take on copper and base metals here?
Bearish copper and bearish crude oil. So that's what I'm very fearful about, is gold up, bullish gold, bearish crude oil and copper, the industrial metals. And the problem with copper overall is China. Number one thing is China and the dollar. So copper has one of the highest correlations to China. So you look at China PMIs. We all know what's happening with the trade war. It's quite the negative. So first negative for copper is China. Then you look at things like the MSCI China Index or Emerging Market Index, and they're breaking down. Copper just broke through key support. I don't see what's going to really save that in the short term. In the long term, it's more the metal with a PhD in economics. It's indicating quite negative. It's quite a negative indicator. And then I look at copper over gold, and that's been a good indicator for lower yields, and it's been very consistent. And it keeps saying the yields are going lower. And here we are, the 10-year yield right now, and they're 1.75. This started breaking down. So I think that's an enduring trend. I don't think what it's going to take to end. The key things it will take is China PMI is very low. It's near a 10-year low. That needs to recover. It doesn't look like it's going to. And the dollar, the trade-weighted broad dollar is a measure I use. That's one calculated by the New York Fed. that's at the almost the highest levels ever. That needs to peak. And right now, I don't see signs of that peaking. So for overall, copper and crude oil are look quite negative versus the more the precious looks positive. And again, that fits really into the macroeconomic picture, which we all know is the whole outlook has been declining.
Mike, could we very well see a picture when there's this scramble for safety that we could see precious metals and the U.S. dollar rise at the same time? I mean, where are you going to go if you want to return? You can't go to Europe. Almost a third of the debt there is negative. You can't go to Japan. So where are the safe havens? It seems to me it's the dollar and metals.
That's true. And that's what we're seeing right now. Look at on a two-year basis, the trade-weighted broad dollar is up about 8.5%. And gold is up about 16%, so almost double. So that's a divergent sign of strength. And that's gold in U.S. dollars. But gold's rallying for many other reasons. What's happened over that period over the last 2 years? Stock market volatility has gone from the lowest levels in almost 50 years to more still low levels, but it's recovered. So I think that's going to continue. What would really accelerate the trend in gold prices is if the dollar peaks, which you don't see. But the key unique thing is what's really driving U.S. dollar strength is the outperformance of the U.S. stock market, i.e. the key thing we like to look at is the S&P 500 overweighted the MSCI World Index ex-U.S. That has been a very good indicator of dollar strength, and it's potentially peaking now, but overall, you know, it's still that's a unique thing that ties gold to stocks.
You know, I want to talk about something. Let's say that global economies weaken and maybe we get recessions as a result of this trade war. In the last downturn, we saw massive fiscal stimulus. There was a $1 trillion stimulus plan accompanied by massive monetary stimulus. Monetary power seems less potent this time around. A lot of that monetary power went into financial assets more so than in the economy. Could this next round, Mike, see a combination of what we just saw, like the fiscal stimulus that came with the tax cuts? You hear a lot about modern monetary theory, where you basically doesn't matter what your deficits are. But in other words, more fiscal spending as government tries to inject money into the economy, and then you have central banks basically printing to mop it up, which to me would be more inflationary.
That's what we need. I don't see why not. And when I hear that MMT, as you mentioned, all I have to do is just hear serious consideration of such a thing. And I think, oh boy, I need to buy more gold. Because my sense is in this environment, a global deflationary environment, particularly where I see things in commodities, obviously people look at more things like wage inflation, the risk reward of governments not printing more money and not doing more MMT is quite low at this point. I mean, they should be doing that. I mean, until you see some signs of inflation. And I don't see why. And also, you look at from a political standpoint, when there's absolutely no backlash from, you know, deficit spending, politicians will just keep spending until the bond market tells them not to. So that's what I see as there's no end game in sight until the market tells them not to, which means, again, bullish gold and precious metals. And that's what I just look at the debt to GDP. That's, we've had this massive expansion and it continues to increase. And you mentioned fiscal spending. Look, but that's one thing Europe did with austerity. They did that wrong. And look where we are now. They, you know, too much austerity. They have major deflationary problems. We they both, and we're better off, at least not we. I mean, I would say the U.S.
So as you look at this, is this something that you see unfolding over the next year or two? Because obviously, if this trade war continues, you're seeing global supply chains being rearranged right now. Companies are saying they're pulling out of China, and they're going to be looking at ways to avoid these tariffs, because it doesn't look like, Mike, this is something that's going to be temporary. They reach a truce. They resolve it. This looks to be ongoing.
I agree with that. I look at more as that's for the economists, and my main take is how is the market set up for it? So it looks like it's probably going to endure at least into the election. And I don't know what might solve it, but what I look at is the enduring trends that are in place, and this is part of it. We look at the global trade war, but the environment I saw well before was quite negative. I saw crude oil getting its way oversupplied globally, and demand has been declining incrementally. And you look at stock market volatility was the lowest level in 50 years, and there's only room for that to go higher. And I look at the trade war as just part of this global shift lower in economic growth, and I see commodities as the key place. So that's where I'm macro bearish copper, bearish crude oil, bullish gold, and a big part of it is U.S. stock market. But yeah, I guess we need some kind of definitive trade agreement that looks forward and says, yes, we're all green, we're going to do, that would help. But we have an election coming up, and we all know China plays well with voters in the Midwest.
One of the issues that you have when gold moves, it moves suddenly and it can move explosively. A good example is the day you and I are speaking where it's hitting 1475. What would you be advising investors to do here?
Well, that's the thing I have to be careful about, guys, and I make calls and let investors make their own decisions. And to me, gold is going higher. It's a question of how high. My first target is basically here. We're near good resistance now, but I have to admit, I've been quite bullish on gold for 4 or 5 years. And the significance is this last 4 or 5 year period, at least like the last 3 years, I looked at Bollinger Bands and things like that. Some of the narrowest in the history of gold trading since before the 1971 release by Nixon. So I see the fundamentals and technicals as quite positive. I think the first thing we're doing now is retracing the big plunge in 2013. That was 28% decline. It was the worst plunge since 1985, and that started around 1700. So investors have been doing this. You see gold ETF flows almost near the all-time highs. Total holdings in terms of ounces. So investors have been doing that, and I suspect they should continue. And it's one of those things as a part of a diversified portfolio. It's your diversifier that you hope that you hope goes down because everything else goes up, and I'm fearful it's going to continue to go up.
You mentioned the figure 1700. A lot of smart people, Ray Dalio at Bridgewater, Paul Tudor Jones. You have a lot of big hedge fund money that is talking about the 1700. Is that the first stopping point, or could we actually go beyond that and exceed prior levels reached at 1900?
Well, I think we should. It's a question of time and define time. Now, it's significant. It's hard to define time. That's the thing why I look at gold is it's nothing, it's breaking out higher, but it's all it's doing is retracing previous levels. It's retracing bear market levels. Similar in Bitcoin. All it's doing is retracing last year's bear market. That's the difference with most other financial assets like the stock market. S&P 500 recently was at an all-time high. As you mentioned, the last time the Fed started an easing cycle, September 2007, that's when right around the S&P 500 peaked. Now, hopefully that won't happen again, but I look at it as a strategy. It's just retracing old levels. It's picking up steam. Short term, it's going to have resistance, but I don't see what it's going to take to stop it from rallying. And I hope it's not too fast because that's a bad sign for most other assets or risk-on assets like equities.
Yeah, because usually when you see explosive, kind of almost like a NASA space launch, when assets go up that quick, that fast, usually there's a big sell-off and a tumble. So maybe a steady climb forward would be the best for gold investors. Well, listen, Mike, as we close here, if investors and listeners would like to follow your work, you do a lot of great stuff as a commodity strategist for Bloomberg. How could they follow you?
I post most of my stuff on LinkedIn, and I'm happy to do that. I'm Mike McClone, Bloomberg. Mike and LinkedIn, Bloomberg Commodity Strategist. So that's probably the easiest, quickest way. I'm on Twitter too. You can find my name there, Mike McGlone 11, I think. I just don't follow Twitter as much. I never really have time to respond, but I mostly LinkedIn. So that's the easiest way. And the primary way is I publish on the Bloomberg Terminal first. Anybody, Bloomberg users, can get that data on the Bloomberg Terminal first.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us on the program. All the best, sir.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Pretty obvious to any observer, trade tensions between the U.S. and China just got a lot worse. President Trump imposed tariffs on another $300 billion of Chinese goods this week. The Chinese fired back by depreciating their currency, which makes their exports cheaper, and by saying they're going to stop buying American agricultural products. The White House returns the fire by declaring that China is a currency manipulator. Where does all this go? Well, it's hard to know, and probably the two countries themselves aren't really sure, but here are three scenarios. First, the two countries move into a full-bore trade war. More U.S. tariffs, more Chinese counter-tariffs, a continued refusal by China to buy agricultural goods, which are so important to the U.S., a downward spiral in this relationship in which each side tries to make the trade fight more painful politically for the other. That doesn't seem very likely because the mutual damage economically would be too great. Second, the current bluster is merely hiding progress that's going on behind the scenes in negotiations between the two countries, and that they're actually headed toward a deal later this year, perhaps at an Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in November, where President Trump and Chinese President Xi will both be in attendance. That's possible. It also doesn't seem very likely, because in conversations with U.S. officials, they insist the Chinese simply aren't giving much ground right now, aren't making the kind of movement forward that would be necessary to have that deal happen by the end of the year. But you never know. In negotiations, the progress often comes at the very end. Third scenario, the Chinese have simply decided to wait out President Trump. They don't see a need to make a deal now because they want to wait and see whether President Trump is reelected in 2020, whether he serves a second term. If he loses in 2020, they can then move in and try to do a deal with another different American president, perhaps one they think will not be so tough on the Chinese.
And until such time as there is a deal, we will be taxing the hell out of China. That's all there is.
Or perhaps President Trump does win, and then they conclude we have to do a deal with him, and the conversation gets more serious at that point. So which of these scenarios is more likely? As I said at the outset, it's hard to know. Chances are the negotiators in the two countries aren't even very sure. The one thing that's certain is we're headed for several weeks of uncertainty, at least, if not several months.
Well, that was Gerald Seib from the Wall Street Journal outlining three possible scenarios of the current trade war between the U.S. and China. It escalated this week with China being named a currency manipulator. The Trump administration announced 10% on $300 billion of Chinese goods, and China allowing its currency to devalue above the 7 level. So instead of moderating and a truce in the trade war, things have taken a sharper negative turn, and that rattled markets around the globe this week. So where does this go, and for how long? What will it mean for the economy and the financial markets? That's the topic for discussion in this week's Big Picture.
Well, Chris, it's now official. Economists are no longer calling it trade tensions, trade battle, or trade dispute. It's being labeled for what it really is, a trade war. And it doesn't look like it will get resolved soon. Now, there may be a truce towards the end of the year. Here's the thing. The Chinese, as Gerald Seib pointed out in option three, are counting on waiting Trump out, hoping for a Democrat win next November, and perhaps a newer president would not be as tough as Trump. And as we're doing this show, the president was leaving the White House, and they basically asked him, was a deal in the cards? And he said, I'm in no hurry to do a deal. And of course, the markets didn't like it, which is one reason we're down on this Friday.
Well, Jim, what about that third option of waiting out Trump? They know an economic recession next year, even a bear market, could very well end the Trump presidency. So applying economic pressure and refusing to negotiate in good faith, couldn't that be a better win, a better option for the Chinese?
Well, sure. I mean, the best option at this point would be a truce with a way to, let's say, postpone a real resolution until after the election. The president of China doesn't have to go what Trump's going to go through, which is a very nasty presidential election. And I think, Chris, Trump is smart enough to know that if there's a recession or a bear market, that would end his chances for a second term. So there is the possibility of some sort of short-term truce or compromise. I just don't see him being very adamant and very adversarial going into 2020, but I could be wrong. But the longer this goes on, the greater the risk of recession, not only here, but abroad as well. This week, Germany, Europe's strongest economy, could be at a risk for a recession with a major drop in industrial production. Globally, we're seeing economies are weakening around the globe this week alone. And think of this, four major central banks cut interest rates. The Philippine Central Bank cut interest rates by a quarter of a point on Thursday to 4.25. On Wednesday, India, New Zealand, and Thailand all cut their key lending rates, surprising the markets, with New Zealand cutting by nearly half a point. So New Zealand seems to be adopting one of the strategies that Fed Governor Williams is talking about. Sooner is a better approach to easing than other central banks, which have been dropping rates at only a quarter point at a time. So the trade war is having an impact globally, and especially in Asia and Europe, which are more heavily dependent on foreign trade. So, Chris, it isn't just a risk of a recession here in the U.S., but it may happen sooner overseas, as the Chinese appear to be allowing their currency to depreciate, and that impacts many of its trading partners throughout Asia, which is why over the last month. You've seen South Korea cut its interest rates. The Philippines have cut their interest rates. Japan is talking about doing it. So nobody, including the Swiss, want a strong currency, and that includes the U.S.
Well, you mentioned the impact on Asia. Wouldn't this be a good impact for the United States? I mean, the president claims we're taking in billions from the Chinese in the form of tariffs. So wouldn't that be a positive for the United States?
Well, if you look at it, Treasury just reported the U.S. took in $63 billion in tariffs as of June 30th of this year. Now, if this 10% tariffs go into effect September, and that would be placed on $300 billion worth of goods, the U.S. would take in approximately $72 billion this year. And next year, with these tariffs remaining in place, basically on everything the Chinese sell us, they could take in $100 billion. But remember, the Chinese aren't paying that. It's U.S. companies and U.S. consumers who are really paying those tariffs by having to pay higher prices for the goods they import. The 10% tariffs that would go into effect in September would mainly be borne by consumers because they're mainly going to be on consumer-type items. The government may be taking in revenues, but those revenues are being paid for by Americans in the form of higher prices.
Well, I can see where the impact would be negative for Americans. So when does this end? It does seem like it's getting worse. And as you said, it really is a trade war now.
Yeah, the trade war is going beyond the election. The Chinese have been operating unfairly in international trade, from manipulating their currency to the theft of intellectual property to stealing our technology. What you're seeing take place, which is unsettling in the short term, and I think this is impacting business investment, is that global supply chains are being reconfigured, with many companies pulling out of China and they're relocating their factories elsewhere to avoid the new tariffs. Now, all of this is part of a process of what we call weaponizing economic tools now that politics are having a larger influence on economics. I mean, Chris, if you think about what you and I have been talking about probably over the last 12 months, it is the major impact of politics on this market. What did we talk about last year? We spent the whole year talking about Fed rate hikes, including in the fourth quarter when we thought the Fed was getting too hawkish. What did we talk about in the first half of this year? We've been talking about two things. We've been talking about the Fed doing a 180 in lowering interest rates instead of raising them, which was the plan at the beginning of the year. And then what else are we talking about? We're talking about the trade war. So it's not just supply chains that are going to be readjusting, but portfolio repositioning will also become more important to take advantage of more liquidity being injected into the markets. Now, you heard, for example, John Roque earlier talking about the way that we're going, and we're really in unprecedented territory right now. If John Roque is right, and I think there's a good possibility, think of this. A third of all sovereign debt is negative. Think in the next 2 years if all sovereign debt is negative. Now, it's great for governments. Imagine issuing debt. Let's say, Chris, you borrowed money from a bank. Instead of paying the bank interest, the bank paid you interest for borrowing money from. It's kind of like saying, hey, Chris, you're a good customer. We like giving you money, and we're going to pay you to take our money. I mean, everybody would love it. So markets are going to get more volatile. Interest rates are going to be heading lower, and there's going to be a global scramble for yields. Recently, Jim Rickards, in his new book, Aftermath, talks about China's mercantilism policies, and he said it made the country the fastest major growing economy in the world. Now, while free trade policies have hollowed out much of U.S. manufacturing, in fact, Rickards points out America's greatest periods of prosperity were associated with tariffs and mercantilism until probably the late 1990s, when globalism really stepped up. So look for this trade war to continue. This isn't something that's going to go away with presidential tweets. This is going to go much, much further, because as I say right now, the era of globalism is coming to an end, and you're going to see more and more companies bring their factories back to the U.S. because they want to avoid these tariffs, and you're going to see more of this go on around the world. China has lofty goals of becoming the most advanced economy technologically, as well as the world's largest. The U.S. is unlikely to let this happen, so this trade war is just in its infancy.
So we saw stocks sell off sharply initially. Bond yields plunged to the lowest level that we've seen since 2016. In fact, the 10-year Treasury falling below 2%. It's currently at around 1.62% as of this Friday. Now, 30-year Treasury yields, they've fallen below 3%, and the three-month T-bill is above 2%. So right now, we have an inverted yield curve, which many are saying is signaling a possible recession next year.
Well, if we take a look at what's happened, and especially in the last month, we've seen the 10-year note drop by 41 basis points. That's almost half a percentage point. That's the widest gap we've seen since March of 2007. But such an inversion as we now have has preceded every recession in the last half century. But just as I mentioned, as we were discussing with John Roque, this inverted yield curve may not have the same implications it did in the past when you have so many central banks intervening in the bond market, so it's distorting this. But I think what the bond market is doing, the message is it's sending the Fed, is that the Fed is moving too slow to lower rates and could be behind the curve. Traders are now pricing in an 83% probability of a half a point cut at the September meeting, and additional cuts of a quarter of a point either in October by over 63%, and a 38% probability of another quarter point cut in December. So if you look beyond this year, the probability of additional cuts next year could take the Fed funds rate down to 1%, are rising almost every single month. Now, if we get down to those levels, it will look more and more like a recession next year. That may be the message of the bond market that tends to get it right more often than not. Many well-known experts we've had here on the program have had very successful calls, and they're calling for the 10-year yield to fall as low as 1% by next year. And some think it'll go below 1%. And as John Roque mentioned, he thinks in the next couple of years, we could see negative interest rates globally. If that happens, that'll be the first time in recorded human history. The other thing that we're starting to see going on right now is junk bond spreads are starting to widen again, with the yield spread over low-quality debt now 4.5% above equivalent treasuries. The average yield on junk bonds has risen recently over 6%, while treasury yields are falling close to 1.6%. Now, the jump in yields reflects concerns that these trade tensions could tip the global economy into a downturn that would hit the finances of a lot of these highly leveraged companies particularly hard. High-yield debt is often sometimes called the canary in the coal mine when it comes to a recession. So what do we have? So right now, we have an inverted yield curve. We've got widening credit spreads, weakening PMIs like Germany that are strongly signaling economic weakness, as well as the futures market signaling a 1 full percentage point cut in the Fed funds rate by the end of the year. So we are really living, if you think about it, in historical times. I've never seen yields this low in my entire career in the industry, nor have I ever seen, as what we're seeing today, negative yields. Now, realizing this has never occurred in 5,000 years of recorded human history. So when you see what you're seeing today throughout much of Europe, Japan, where the majority of yields are negative, or let's say well below U.S. yields, you have all of the central banks of the world's largest economies are currently lowering rates, including four this week. And more importantly, they're doing so from much lower levels than the last financial crisis. So with a third of all sovereign debt being negative, not one country wants a strong currency, so they're lowering rates to weaken their currencies, or in the case of the Swiss, they're actually intervening in the currency markets.
So, Jim, let's break this down for investors then. What do you see here?
Well, with yields heading lower as they're doing now, we've been lengthening maturity since the beginning of the year on our bond holdings. It's our belief, Chris, that interest rates on bonds are going to be heading lower, so we've been locking in yields for our clients. We also like beating down blue chip stocks in the tech sector, healthcare, and the energy sector. And let's talk a moment about energy. The energy sector has suffered the most and is ridiculously oversold. And let me give you an example of this. Since 2016, when the oil market bottomed, oil prices have risen 110% to where they are today, energy stocks like the ones in popular ETF XLE are up just 19%. Now think about that. Oil's up 110%. Energy stocks are up less than 20%. Some of the best yields, bar none, are in the energy sector, where yields can be found between 4 and 6% and very commonplace on some of the best quality energy companies in the world. Now, you might think, well, should I buy? The only reason not to buy would be if you believe oil is heading back to $20 a barrel. Now, a lot of the information out there that is being missed is that the U.S. production isn't rising as fast as originally estimated, and that oil demand, now, the IEA just lowered their demand estimates for the fourth time this year, but it's still up by 1.1 million barrels. So last year, and here's the other one that nobody expected and nobody's talking about. Last year, oil demand grew at the fastest pace in a decade. It grew by 3%. So right now, we have bond yields that are heading lower. The Fed is cutting interest rates. I believe high-quality blue-chip stocks that pay dividends are going to be one of the places to be. In effect, they're replacing bonds as there is a global scramble in search of yield. I would say the best place to be right now is in high-quality dividend-paying blue-chip stocks where, Chris, you can get yields all the way from as low as 3 all the way up to as high as 6%.
So, Jim, what about gold? I'm curious about that. You know, it seems to be a winner. John Roach says it's likely to take out a new high. But what about hard assets? It's another winner this week because prices rose above $1,500 an ounce. And that's something we've not seen in, about 5 years, I think.
Yeah, the two biggest winners, what I call the fear trade right now, have been treasuries, which have dropped in yield by almost 0.5%. And precious metals like gold and silver, along with gold and silver stocks, from majors all the way to the juniors. Now, we like gold here and are going to be adding further to our gold position. But we're also beginning to look at silver, which is another asset that is grossly undervalued, like energy. If you look at the gold and silver ratio, it's currently roughly about 89. Historically, it's averaged around 75 over the last 5 years and about 67 over the last 10 years. That would imply silver should be closer to $20 to $22 an ounce instead of where it is today at close to $17. So in my opinion, I think both gold and silver are heading higher, but silver should eventually play catch up.
So Jim, what do you see coming up in the weeks ahead that listeners should be careful to watch?
Okay, if we take a look at the futures market, it's pricing in a probability of over 80% that in September, the Fed will cut interest rates by 0.5 point. Now, coming up towards the end of this month, we'll have the Fed conclave at Jackson Hole. So we're going to be looking, you know, what does Fed Chair Powell say, or what does other Fed governors say about rate hikes? Now, remember, in the last FOMC meeting, Powell kind of threw the markets off kilter by saying, hey, this is only a mid-cycle slowdown that we're going through now, not the beginning of a rate-cutting process. We're going to look for any change in that kind of language. That's coming up. And of course, we'll be heading into September. And usually the end of August and September, for whatever reason, it's kind of like hurricane season in the financial markets. And certainly we have a lot of fodder out there and a lot of warnings that the markets could become more volatile, from presidential tweets to God knows anything else that comes out politically. So we'll be keeping a close eye on that. Hope you will too. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.